In the coming week, Secretary of State Blinken unveils the Biden administration's China strategy, Colombians vote in a presidential election, and a new foreign affairs podcast debuts. It's May 26, 2022, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, as we're taping this podcast, there is a major closely watched speech being given by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. It is at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C., and it follows President Biden's just completed first visit to Asia, where I would say China was a major subtext. What are some of the biggest points we should look for in the speech?
Bob, Secretary Blinken no doubt wishes he could have given his speech before President Biden's trip to Asia. Coming after the fact drains the speech of much of its impact, doubly so in terms of its impact here in the conversation within the United States, given that the news here at home is being dominated by the horrific mass shooting that left 19 schoolchildren and two elementary school teachers in Uvalde, Texas, dead. My heart goes out to all of the families involved into the community of Uvalde. As the father of four, I can't even begin to imagine the pain of losing your child in that terrible way. Now, the fact that Secretary Blinken is giving this speech 16 months after President Biden took the oath of office shows how slow the Biden team, for all of its foreign policy experience, has been in deciding the details rather than the general orientation of its China policy. Secretary Blinken had this great line, which he delivered in the first month of the administration, that U.S. policy toward China should be competitive when it should be, collaborative when it can be, and adversarial when it must be. Terrific formulation. One problem, it doesn't tell you which issues fall into which buckets, or precisely what steps you should take when you know which bucket an issue is in. Now, the administration has been very slow to get to this point because it has been racked by infighting over what its policy should be, particularly over the question of whether President Biden should lift the tariffs that President Trump imposed on China. Those tariffs backfired just in the way economists predicted. China retaliated in kind. American producers got shut out of the Chinese market, and the U.S. government has had to spend billions to keep American farmers afloat. Now, lifting some or all of those tariffs would be doing Americans a favor, but the administration prefers for the moment to stick with its neo-Trumpian trade policy. So it's not clear that Secretary Blinken is going to have much of anything new to say. Certainly, State Department officials haven't pre-briefed Blinken's speech in a way to suggest he's going to unveil significant new steps or initiatives. And what I will say is that while the Biden administration has been busily debating in-house what his policy should be, China has been acting. We spoke several weeks ago about the deal that China struck with the Solomon Islands. Beijing is not standing still. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, is meeting with the heads of 10 Pacific Island nations next week in Fiji. Think the Solomon Islands, Kiribati, Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, Vanuatu, Papua New Guinea, Niue, and the Federated States of Micronesia. He is coming to the meeting bringing an offer for a regional agreement under which Beijing would help, I'll put that in air quotes, these countries with policing, maritime surveillance, cybersecurity, and education. U.S. government officials can say all they want that China is offering a poison chalice to these countries, but the reality is you can't beat something with nothing. Now, I don't know whether or not the Chinese gambit here is going to be successful. The president of the Federated States of Micronesia has gone on record saying that he believes China is, and let me quote him here, seeking to control our region, end quote. But clearly, the game is afoot in the South Pacific.
Jim, one thing I want to turn back to is something we've talked about in previous podcasts as well, is that issue of, is the U.S. not doing enough or not capitalizing enough on the opportunities for an economic partnership that could counter China while also maintaining ties with China that continue to be crucial? I mean, is there something there that is still more reactive than proactive?
Well, the administration has been very reactive on the economic front, Bob. For all the talk about the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or IPEF, there's a lot less there than meets the eye. There's a really good piece written by Deborah Elm of the Asia Trade Center, which is based in Singapore. Deborah writes a lot of really good stuff on the trade front from the perspective of the country in East and Southeast Asia. And she likened IPEF to issuing an invitation to a party no one wants to attend because the food is too bland, the music undanceable, and the activities are only ones that interest the host. And that's the problem. Yes, the Biden administration has put something on the table, but it doesn't appear to have many very eager takers. Reason why is the Biden administration refuses to talk about market access, that is the ability to sell goods into the United States. Short of that, countries aren't terribly interested, and they're going off making their own deals. We've spoken a number of times on this podcast, China looking to get into the comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. China has already orchestrated RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, another trade deal in Asia, not as far-reaching as CPTPP, but nonetheless significant because it is giving China an opportunity to help write the trade rules and investment rules in that part of the world. And again, you can assume that China is not going to try to write rules. They're going to do favors to the United States.
So it's, even though the speech that we're talking about today very much focused on the foreign policy community, think tanks like ours are focusing on this. It's delivered at GW, right in the heart of Washington's Foggy Bottom and so forth.
Just several blocks from where we are right now, Bob.
Just a few blocks away. There's a domestic component here that I think you're getting at, Jim, which is that trade is not a popular issue, not an issue to really run on, certainly not in a midterm year. And yet it seems to be the crucial aspect in terms of how the U.S. is going to compete with China, but also win with China, let's say, because we are still interdependent with China in a lot of things, but also compete in terms of creating bold new trade relationships. And yet that's just not something that either party wants to get involved in. It seems like both parties, another area of bipartisan agreement is to talk tough on China, but not talk in ways that involve expanding trade.
Well, you're right, Bob. I mean, if you think of U.S. policy toward Asia, it really is a table with three legs. One, presumably, is military. One would be economic. One would be diplomatic, political. In terms of the military, the Biden administration has been very forward-leaning, continuing the freedom of navigation operations that the Trump administration pursued. We have the AUKUS deal. We have repeated talk about our commitment to upholding our treaty obligations in the region. So the military leg of the table is working very well. If you look at the diplomatic political aspect, positive signs that the administration is showing up at meetings, those are good things. But the political diplomatic leg is also weakened by the fact of January 6th and the broader sense of political dysfunction, polarization here in the United States, the whole question of whether or not you can depend on the United States going forward, or will we see in 2025 a different president, an entirely different approach to those issues? So second potential leg is a weaker, fragile leg. And then you have the economic leg, and essentially it doesn't exist. And so, you know, you're not going to have a stable table with only 1.5 legs.
So we'll see if this message resonates in the U.S., but also how China might respond. There was already a lot of scuttlebutt involving the administration's Taiwan policy or whether or not it had come out with a new one. But we'll see, as you indicated at the top, Jim, China's not sitting still and moving vigorously in the region. We'll see what it reads from the U.S. messaging, I guess.
That's the important point, Bob. China isn't simply responding with words. It is acting, and it is actively trying to redraw the map and the dynamics and the rules on the ground. And, you know, the phrase that my kids like to use is snooze, you lose. I think that applies to geopolitics as well. But Bob, let's shift gears and take our conversation to Colombia, where a presidential election is set to take place this coming Sunday, May 29th. Some of the biggest issues on the ballot are the economy, corruption, and crime. So far, Colombia's far-left candidate, Senator Gustavo Petro, is the frontrunner in the race for the presidency. But tell us a bit more about who Senator Petro is and what we need to know heading into this Colombian election, Bob.
Jim, Petro is a fascinating story and a real potential change agent at a time when seemingly every election in the region is ushering in some sort of non-traditional, non-institutional candidate to change things around. He is, we should start out a little bit of his interesting bio. He was a former guerrilla fighter for the 19th of April movement known as M19. This is not the main guerrilla group that had been part of the long civil war in Colombia, which is the FARC, but still in all a guerrilla movement. He later became mayor, though, talk about turnarounds, became mayor of the capital city, Bogota. He was leading, according according to most recent polls, up to 40% of support respondents like him as a change agent. His running mate, we should note, Francia Marquez, would be the first Black vice president if they are elected. And he is calling for sweeping changes. You cannot underscore this enough in terms of, especially in the economic and environmental front, transitioning away from fossil fuels, which account for something like 60% of Colombia's total exports, and toward renewable sources, solar, wind, hydropower, talking about emphasizing tourism as a cash generator for Colombia. And among the reasons for this is Colombia, like many countries in region, has very severe inequality. 40% of the country lives in poverty. There are food price jumps. Last month, food price jumps were measured at more than 25% from the previous year. So you have a severe problem there. And he is saying things that are resonating. He's talking about the federal government providing basic needs and rights like education and health, and using its largesse to make sure that it is sort of rebalancing this huge inequality in the country. And so it's a major leftist turn he's running against. Among others, the main conservative candidate is the former mayor of Medellin, Federico Gutierrez, who's not calling for the transition away from fossil fuels, among other things. And he's also running against an independent candidate who seems to be gaining of late, named Rodolfo Hernandez. So we are looking at there was just a report in today's New York Times about this sort of historic youth bulge in Colombia, which could end up, you know, defining these elections. A huge number of young Colombians voting for the first time who have shown support for his change message as well, Gustavo Petro's change message. So this is going to be something to really watch. It does look like he's going to need, he might not have enough votes to win outright. So that looks like a two-candidate runoff in June, Jim, but very much change in the air for the country of Colombia.
Bob, what is it that Senator Petro is saying he would do as president to address all of these problems? Let's just take the issue of inflation. This is not a problem specific to Colombia. This looks to be a global problem, particularly when we look at food price inflation. The war in Ukraine is having tremendous knock-on effects on global commodity prices, grain prices, and the like. It's not obvious what it is that the head of any individual country can do to stem that surge in prices.
You know, you're not seeing some hard and fast practical, I haven't seen, at least in the coverage, you know, so how this drills down into the practical approach to fighting inflation. Other than that, he plans to take steps that he says the country has avoided taking for years in terms of rebalancing, further taxing richer members of the country, making this transition that he thinks will put the country on a better footing in terms of what it's dependent on for energy, so that, you know, not as vulnerable to inflation as it pertains to energy areas. In terms of feeding the poor and feeding the people, I think it's this message we've heard from Central American, especially leftist candidates before, which is that, you know, the government will do more to make food and basic services available to the poor. Now, sometimes that could be done in blunt ways, as we saw in Venezuela, for example. We also saw a bit of populism playing out in Venezuela, where at the end of the day, the pro-Chavista elements were the ones who had gained the most. But you could point to, at least in some parts of the transformation in Venezuela's early days, you know, you had more attention paid to serving poor areas, and that made Hugo Chavez very, very popular initially. It's a neighboring country. It's an interesting playbook that they might want to follow, but there's also cautionary tales. Venezuela is close to a failed state right now, and Colombia itself has dealt with the influx of millions of Venezuelans across the border into its country, where it has been relatively much better off. So there's a lot of things that are kind of treacherous for Colombia to be considering right now. But Petro has been, you know, coming out with this consistent message that he's going to sort of flip the calculus in the country, Jim.
Well, we certainly hope that Colombia doesn't go down the road that Venezuela has gone down, because it is pretty clear that Chavez and then Maduro have immiserated Venezuela. You've seen, as you mentioned, large numbers of Venezuelans, millions of them, leaving the country because things are so desperate. We've been talking to this point, Bob, about domestic conditions in Colombia. What would Petro's elections mean for U.S.-Colombian relations? Washington and Bogota have worked very closely over the last couple of decades. Many American experts would point to Plan Colombia as playing a significant role in leading to the end of the Colombian Civil War and curtailing the drug trade. Are those close relations potentially in jeopardy?
I think we'd have to consider that, Jim, and for a number of reasons. Yes, for starters, as a former guerrilla fighter, he comes from a certain part of Colombian society, Petro I'm talking about. He has been making gestures towards improving relations with Venezuela and working with the Maduro government, which has had a very chilled relationship with the U.S., although we should point out the U.S. has made some recent overtures towards engaging with the Venezuelans, certainly in different ways than the Trump administration had. But still in all, you could get a different overture traffickers from Colombia towards Venezuela. And then there's the drug fighting issue. There's cocaine production by many accounts is at record highs in the country. It's of great concern to the U.S., where it continues to be a pipeline to the supply there. The U.S. would like to continue to ramp up pressure on that. And part of that has involved the U.S. relationship with the Colombian military. And this is something that's going to be worth watching because you've had what looks to be very kind of harsh language by Petro towards the Colombian military. And potentially you could see that relationship worsening or something that affects that relationship. And as a through line, it could affect the way the U.S. is able to partner with Colombia. Another initial test right out of the gate will be a summit of the Americas that the United States is hosting in Los Angeles in June. It might be too soon for the U.S. to gauge a new Colombian leadership at that summit, but it is going to be a way of testing the temperature about what change might be in the offing and how this really rock-ribbed U.S. alliance, which includes trade issues, by the way, could be affected by someone who's coming in and giving vent to grievances that have been simmering for a long time, including anti-U.S. grievances.
One of the challenges, obviously, is that the Biden administration's attention, Bob, is focused on China. It's focused on Russia. It hasn't been focused on Latin America, even though I think the Biden team came in hoping to elevate relations with countries in Latin America. But I think looking forward, those relations are going to be buffeted by a lot of stiff winds.
Yeah. And part of that is just the democracy issue. You know, the U.S., I think, in setting up the summit, for example, the Summit of the Americas was trying to give a lot of play to the issue of promoting democracy and not inviting to the summit anti-democratic regimes like in Venezuela or Cuba or Nicaragua. And yet it's getting pushback from countries in the region like Mexico and among others. So part of it is going to be an attendance issue at that particular summit, but also the broader messaging in the region. You know, is the U.S. going to be engaging in kind of a regular realpolitik? Is it going to be pushing a pro-democracy agenda? And by the way, we've had some successful elections and transfers of power in Latin America in the most recent ones that and certainly the ones we've talked about in this podcast, Chile, for example, and Peru. And so there could be a story to tout here, but it's also, as always, a region in which the U.S. has to be very careful in its messaging.
Certainly is the case, Bob. But again, I expect a lot more turbulence in the months to come. Bob, let's turn our conversation to something that's happening today. That's the launch of Foreign Affairs Magazine's new podcast, The Foreign Affairs Interview.
And with us today to talk about The Foreign Affairs Interview is the show's host, Daniel Kurtz-Valen. Dan is editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine and the Peter G. Peterson Chair at CFR. Previously, he spent 3 years as executive editor of Foreign Affairs and served in the U.S. State Department, including as a member of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff. After this week, Dan will have to add podcast host to his resume. Dan, thanks so much for stopping by The World Next Week.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
So Dan, congrats on the launch of the Foreign Affairs Interview. Tell us about it.
So we hope to do a few things with this podcast. It is a long-form interview podcast where we sit down with foreign affairs authors, many of whom have written multiple times for the magazine. Sometimes they've written something recent. Sometimes they wrote years ago and are now serving in government. But the idea is really to open up to our listeners and to longtime foreign affairs readers and others the kinds of conversations that we have with authors when we are working on a long essay. And, you know, what we hope to do when we publish an essay is have pieces that have a kind of iceberg quality to them. So they should be, you know, readable and accessible and clear, but all of those should have underneath that surface analysis just an incredible amount of research and experience and expertise. And so part of what you'll get in these conversations with authors is everything that is part of that essay, but might not be clear from reading it in the magazine.
So Dan, we know there's some people who are writers and some people who are speakers and some people who are speakers and writers. Are there people you have a pretty good sense of who are writing for the magazine that you know, whether it's innately or you know through experience, this person would be great in a podcast?
So our first guest is a perfect example of someone who combines all of these qualities. It's Stephen Kotkin, great historian of Russia and the Soviet Union, who is a beautiful writer, an incredible scholar, and a fascinating person to listen to. So it's hard to ask for a better first guest than Kotkin. And you know what we'll hope to do in the podcast is what we do in the editing process with the magazine, where we take people who might have great expertise in a certain area, they might have incredible experience in government or as a practitioner somewhere, and helping them bring that experience or bring that expertise into a somewhat wider policy and public conversation. And that is a big part of what we're doing at the magazine, is bringing different kinds of expertise, different kinds of perspectives into one common conversation about the biggest issues of the day in foreign policy and international affairs. And the podcast should really do that in a different way.
So I take it, Dan, that the idea isn't simply to recap an article, but to use the article as a launching point for a broader discussion.
That's right. That's well put, that it should You know, if, even if you've read the piece, you will be able to listen to an episode of the podcast and I think get a lot more than you got just from the piece. It will also provide an entry point into some of our work for those who might not already be regular readers or subscribers. It also gives us a chance to take pieces that remain really relevant but might have been written 2 or 3 or 5 years ago and apply them to events that have transpired since. And again, let me use our first episode as an example. Stephen Kotkin has written a slew of really fantastic essays about how Russia approaches the world and how Russian foreign policy works. There's one that he wrote in 2016 called Russia's Perpetual Geopolitics that to me is one of the clearest and most incisive explanations of what Vladimir Putin is doing in Ukraine. And this episode gives us a chance to bring that analysis up to date. So it is using those pieces as a launching pad, but offers something quite distinct.
Dan, Foreign Affairs is joining an august group of classic publications that have moved into podcasting and even multimedia. For those who aren't aware, Foreign Affairs has a terrific website. In addition to the famous blueback Foreign Affairs editions, there's the website, foreignaffairs.com. Is there something about podcasts? We seem to be in an early golden age of podcasting, if I could use that term. But is there something about podcasts that you like yourself as a consumer that you want to try to convey through Foreign Affairs?
The thing that's so appealing about this format for us is that it really allows you to get into depth and have a real conversation with someone who brings real expertise and to do that in a way that can be accessible to a lot of listeners. So there are people who will have an appetite to read, you know, 5,000 words in the print magazine or a couple of thousand words on the website. This gives another way to access some of these thinkers and some of these ideas that is still really substantive and really allows you to get into a good amount of substance. But, you know, that's a little bit harder to do on a cable TV hit or something like that. But the podcast form really allows you to do that. So we thought we could kind of take the Foreign Affairs DNA, take what we try to do in a piece on the website, a piece in the magazine, and do that in the podcast form.
Dan, I should note that 2022 is the centennial of the founding of Foreign Affairs. Did you wait to launch a podcast so you could mark the centennial?
That's right. It seems like exactly the kind of thing we should be doing as we think about what the next 100 years of Foreign Affairs looks like. And there are a number of different ways that we're trying to take, again, that kind of core DNA of what we've done and what the magazine has done at its best over that 100-year history and do it in new formats. And part of that's about reaching different audiences. Part of that's about reaching our regular readers and loyal subscribers with more content. So our basic standard is if we think we can do it well and think we can kind of bring the ambition and quality that we would adhere to in any of the more traditional products to something new, then we will explore it. And the podcast is one of these things just fortuitously timed with our 100th birthday.
So Dan, if I'm downloading the Foreign Affairs interview, what sort of length am I getting? What sort of frequency? How's it going to be coming out into the podcast realm?
We're going to be doing this to start every other week. So it'll be on a bi-weekly schedule. We think that most of these conversations will be around 40 or 45 minutes. So enough time to really get into some depth and start to understand an issue or spend some time getting to know a particular thinker or policymaker, but hopefully not so much time that it will scare off most listeners. So we will try to stick to that length and do it bi-weekly. And if we can ramp up from there, we will.
Well, it's a very exciting development, Dan. The first episode of the Foreign Affairs interview debuts today, Thursday, May 26th. Listeners can find new episodes of the podcast every other Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dan, again, congratulations on the launch of Foreign Affairs Interview, and thank you for coming on The World Next Week to tell us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that brings us to our Audience Figure of the Week segment of the podcast, in which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience selected Pakistan pro-con rally. Jim, why is this figure significant?
The figure is significant, Bob, because political turmoil is growing in Pakistan. It could potentially lead to widespread violence. Now, I have to say right up front, this is a fluid situation, and by the time the podcast airs, some significant facts may have changed. But the background, as we've discussed in past shows, is that Imran Khan, the Pakistani national cricket star turned prime minister, lost a no-confidence vote last month. He was booted from office in good part because Pakistan's economy is in a nosedive. The Pakistanis are currently in negotiations with the IMF about resuming a $6 billion rescue package that was first agreed to back in 2019. Now, Khan alleges that he lost the prime ministership as part of a U.S.-led plot to install his successor, Shahbaz Sharif, in office. Why the Biden administration is unable to agree on a policy toward China but can run Pakistani politics is left unclear in this conspiracy theory. But since being turfed out, Khan has been pushing for the dissolution of parliament and new elections, which otherwise wouldn't be held until next year. To make that call a reality, he has called on his supporters to march on the nation's capital, Islamabad, and stage a sit-in until the government agrees to new elections. Those marches have begun, and the Sharif government has responded by using trucks and shipping containers to block all major roads into Islamabad. The same has happened to the exit and entrances to nearby major cities. Khan supporters have responded by trying to remove the roadblocks. Having a flair for the dramatic, Khan actually earlier this week helicoptered into one of those marches about 60 miles north of Islamabad. And what happened this morning is that Khan announced that he was asking his supporters to hold off on their march for 6 days. And he gave the Pakistani government essentially an ultimatum that within 6 days, the government has to call for new elections. And this is clearly going to be a pivotal potential showdown moment in Pakistani politics. Obviously, waiting off in the wings is the question of what will the Pakistani military do? They have intervened in Pakistani politics overtly before, widely believed to pull many of the strings in Pakistani politics quietly behind the scenes. But events in Pakistan are greatly concerning. Remember, of course, that Pakistan is a nuclear armed power.
Jim, that's a whole lot of things to add to our worry list. But I'm wondering, your reference to the military, do we have a sense of whether the military is kind of biding its time and whether it might just sort of step in and say, enough of this, we need to move ahead? You know, the country is dealing with its regular array of security challenges, including the Pakistani Taliban threat that poses. Neighboring Afghanistan is in no great shape. Sri Lanka is dealing with upheaval as well. And there's a gigantic heat wave on top of everything else that's hit South Asia, Pakistan and India in particular. So do we get a sense where maybe it's just the political temperatures might be dialed down by the military?
We don't know, Bob. I mean, I would just put that as a big question mark. Obviously, given Pakistan's history, military intervention is not unthinkable. But the challenge for the military would be, do they want to own these problems at this moment? And is there agreement among senior military leaders about where they want to take the country? So again, this is one of those issues where we can guess at what might happen. I don't think anyone knows what will happen. It's worth paying attention to. I would also put it in a broader context. And again, this goes back to our discussion about the challenges facing Colombia. I would expect over the next 6 to 12 to 18 months, we're going to see a lot more political turmoil in many more countries because of the surge in commodity prices, food prices going up, inflation going up, the ripple effects of things like the Federal Reserve raising interest rates in the United States. As these things work their way through the economy, you're going to see a bigger squeeze on poor people, middle class people. That is going to have consequences for politics all around the world.
Well, that's our look at the turbulent world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Chilean President Gabriel Boric delivers Chile's annual State of the Nation speech, and Albania takes over the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. Special thanks to Dr. Margaret Gatch and Rafael Urcina for their assistance.
Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis, who doubled as our recording engineer, thanks Zoe, and with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. And for those who have listened to this podcast through the years, they have heard the name Jeremy Sherlick many times. Today's episode of The World Next Week is the last episode Jeremy will serve as our senior producer. He has been promoted to director of video for digital content at the Council and will be focusing his energies there. Jeremy, I want to give you a hearty thanks for your indispensable part in this effort that we've called TWNW for the last 12 years. And congratulations on your new role at CFR.
Bob, let me echo your congratulations to Jeremy and your thanks for all the hard work he has put into The World Next Week. He has led the production of roughly 600 episodes of the show.
And
he's been with the show since it debuted back in 2007. So he certainly predates my appearance on the show. And I just want Jeremy to know that he will always remain a valued and respected part of the TWNW family. And again, Jeremy, thanks for everything you've done for the show and thing for me.
He really is part of the DNA of this the show. As anybody who does podcasts know, senior producers are part of the DNA.
This really is a team effort to get these episodes out every week. Anyway, this is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay safe out there.